This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, the chairman of the Black is Back Coalition explains what keeps the various groups in the coalition together. A new Poor People's Campaign attempts to mobilize against global economic inequalities. And why are Black teachers disappearing from the classrooms in New York City? But first, there was more active opposition to Donald Trump's inauguration than perhaps to any president since the Civil War. In his inaugural address, Donald Trump tried to frame himself as a champion of the little guy. We spoke with Ajamu Baraka, who ran for vice president on the Green Party ticket.
Well, I think you're absolutely right, and that was the theme that helped to take him to victory. This theme of being concerned about the ordinary person, the person who has been left behind, is something that the Democrats used to champion. But of course, you know, as the right wing of the Democratic Party consolidated power, those kinds of messages ended up disappearing. Of course, you know, Bill Clinton talked about the economy stupid. And in fact, we know that Bill Clinton thought that his wife should emphasize more the economy during this last election. But the smart folks around Hillary Clinton thought it was a better strategy to just demonize Trump. And we see the results. So, yeah, this notion that it's the little people that have been left behind, the working class folks, as the Democrats used to talk about, I mean, that's still a very powerful message, and it's one that, you know, now the Democrats are wanting to go back to, because, of course, they now say that the real reason why Trump won wasn't just because of his appeal to general sort of economic populism, but his appeal to the white workers. So, of course, now we find, like, again, under Bill Clinton, Democrats who are saying that one of the reasons why they lost was because they just weren't sufficiently identified with white folks and the white worker. So, you know, in some ways, history repeats itself, but in other ways, this is a very dangerous environment because the kinds of space that capital has to reform itself, and for someone like Trump to be able to deliver on his messages, his promises to white folks and the white working class, those possibilities aren't there anymore. So we're going to see more of a turn toward more open authoritarianism.
Yes, and it seems that the Democratic response, which is also the response of lots of folks who call themselves progressives, is to blame it all on the Russians and create an anti-Russian movement that doesn't talk much about issues at all.
You know, this is a continuation of the strategies pursued by the Democrats. I think that the propping up this whole anti-Russian, anti-Putin strategy was something that it was a cynical strategy that was pushed by the Clinton folks to box in and expose and embarrass Trump and prop up Hillary Clinton as this new Iron Lady, if you will, who was going to be tough enough to defend American interests against Putin. Now, even though that heightened tensions between the two countries, it didn't really matter because their objective was to win. But that strategy sort of got out of hand. The masses sort of took this thing on. I mean, because, you know, 24 hours of anti-Russian propaganda, I mean, has an effect. And so now, you know, even progressives are now parroting this Democrat line about the Russians did it, even though the intelligence report that Obama and Trump were given said that there's no evidence of direct Russian hacking into the election. And a few days ago, when Obama admitted that the DNC emails were probably leaked as opposed to hacked, then what is the basis of this Russians did it? And the basis of this whole argument about Trump being illegitimate. So this is a strange diversion. And then you have people like John Lewis who will pick this thing up and the other members of the Congressional Black Caucus. And to me, it's a demonstration of the irrationality of politics in the U.S.
Yes, we see the bizarre spectacle of folks who call themselves radicals quoting the CIA as an authority.
It is so bizarre, and I was briefly looking at some of the demos today in D.C., and I saw one sign at one of these quote-unquote progressive demonstrations where it said, Trump and Putin in 2020. Now, this is where we are with so-called progressive politics in the U.S. I mean, complete irrationality, the complete abandonment of critical thought, embracing the state and propping up the intelligence agencies as authoritative sources, even after the weapons of mass destruction and the years of deception, misinformation, psychological operations that we know is the modus operandi of the CIA and the U.S. intelligence agencies. It is absolutely bizarre.
The Green Party, under whose banner you ran for vice president, is doing some soul searching after garnering only 1% of the vote in November. How's that going?
Well, there's still that kind of internal conversation, analysis. I think that many of us had concluded that we were going to generate more than just 1%. But we know that in the end, fair probably won out. But we also know, too, that there are some internal readjustments that need to take place within the Green Party, and that process is unfolding. I mean, the party needs to get positioned to be in a place to, in fact, be the instrument that for those progressive forces who still believe that you can engage the state through the electoral process, that the instrument that they are prepared to use or should probably use, because the only one that's in place right now on the national level, is in fact the Green Party. But the Green Party has to engage in some internal adjustments. It has to be able to make sure that the Green Party is a safe space, that it allows for the kind of internal debates to take place that will help to move the politics to the left, that the party is prepared to, in fact, become a party of the working class and a party of people of color, and that we reject this notion of being concerned about so-called identity politics when the way people are framing this identity politics in a very strange and superficial and backward kind of way. So these kinds of internal conversations are taking place. They have to take place because right now the institutional left is just not in a place to really challenge power. And so to just dismiss the electoral arena altogether is an instrument in one aspect of a broader strategy for shifting and building popular power is a mistake. But the left has always made mistakes.
Yes, one would think that with Donald Trump in power, there would be a fertile field for folks on the left if they weren't consumed with the Russians.
If they weren't consumed with the Russians and if they weren't consumed with anti-Trumpism, and not even defining what that is supposed to mean, that there are issues here that can be pushed in which there's a connection between some of the promises that Trump made to working people, for example, and some of the issues that folks on the progressive left have been pushing, like raising the minimum wage. These kinds of issues are the ones that should be pushed. In the short term, with the dismantlement of the Affordable Care Act, I think that progressives have an opportunity to really take hold of and push the notion of universal health care. We know that Trump has a soft spot for that before he flipped on that issue. So we have some things that if we can look at the issues and figure out how we can begin to organize ourselves to put demands on the state, while at the same time building new kinds of oppositional instruments on the grassroots level, I think that we can make some progress during this next 4 years, especially now that more people are sort of conscious again, if you will.
That was Adamu Baraka, former vice presidential candidate for the Green Party. Lots of groups went to Washington to demonstrate in the week before the inauguration. Most were opposed to or in support of Donald Trump. However, one organization, the Black Is Back Coalition for Social Justice, Peace, and Reparations, rallied at Howard University for a very different reason. According to Chairman Omali Yeshitela, two points of political unity keep the various groups in the coalition together: their commitment to black self-determination and their opposition to U.S. imperialism.
So we establish for ourselves a set of principles that will hold us together. We know we're not part of the same organization. Wouldn't be a coalition if that were the case. We know that this relationship is one that is defined by both unity and it is defined by unity and differences. But the primary aspect of this has been unity, because we have united around these principles. And we also recognize that the coalition is not a substitute for any organization. This is not a substitute for UAPO. UAPO has its own organization, the Universal African People's Organization. And the fact that they're here supporting this coalition, in my estimation, means that people want to work with them and try to find a way to join them. And this is not a substitute for INCORPA, that Wayne Amos Wilson Institute. They have their own organization. And the same thing is true of the New African Business in this part. So this is not a substitute for them. But we are here on these different fronts, fighting against this common enemy, and coming together, we understood that collectively, that each of us becomes stronger as a relation, as a consequence of this relationship. And that's what holds us together. So I just wanted to say this. I think the coalition is extremely important. I haven't seen this thing, and guess what? Not only are we important, not only are we united, but this is something we've been doing going on 8 years now. That's extraordinary. We're looking at a new era in history. A page has been turned in history. And I believe that some people misunderstand this, because a lot of folks are terrified because of the advent of Donald Trump. And you ought to be scared because Trump is in power. But you should have been scared with Clinton doing all this stuff. And you should have been scared with Barack Hussein Obama going to power as well. Because our problem primarily is not him. Our problem is that we have not achieved our own organization and our own platform and our own declaration of an intent to be free. So that meant that we worked with whomever came along. It's like a hitchhiker. When you catch a ride as a hitchhiker, you gotta go wherever the driver's going. And it's better, even if you have an old raggedy car, get your own car. Ride on that. Even if you have to stop every now and fix it and then try to move along, but as long as you're hitchhiking, you're going wherever the hell they're taking you. And that's what being with the Democratic Party was about. You're like hitchhiking. And we determined that day is over. Now, let me tell you this. Trump is president because of crisis of the imperialist social system. White power is in trouble. Everywhere you look around the world, you can see the decline of white power, whether it's in Greece, whether it's in France, everywhere you look, and in the United States, it's in trouble. The capitalist system, which was born from colonialism and slavery, is in trouble. And it's in trouble because a system that requires the mass of the people of the world to be on our belly, functioning as a host for a horrible parasite called capitalism, people are fighting back. The host is fighting back. Fighting back every place from Afghanistan to Venezuela to Harlem, New York, people are fighting back. And it means that the system that has relied on being able to suck the blood of the masses of the people for its own success now is in trouble because it has less blood to suck, and then the people are fighting back. This is the crisis of imperialism that we're looking at. It is a generalized crisis that we're looking at. It has resulted in a situation where an election, which is nothing else in this kind of society than a non-violent contest between different sectors of the ruling class for control of the state for its own profit-making benefit. That's what an election is. And if you didn't know it before, you should have known it when Trump stood up with 17 to 16 other the masses of people. He said, I told Hillary and Bill, my daughter's having a wedding, be there. And he said they were there with bells on, because that's who funded them. And if you didn't know it before, you ought to know it now. When you look at these hearings that's supposed to be determining who's going to be in the cabinet, Trump cabinet, and that's this man Tillerson, who worked for Exxon, and he said that China making all these artificial islands in the South China Sea, not the South Manhattan Sea, right? In the South China Sea, they're not going to be able to do it. And we're going to push them back, et cetera, et cetera. And then, but he didn't say, because in the South China Sea, there are trillions of cubic feet of natural gas and several billion barrels of oil that is in contact, that you're contacting. And then here is Exxon now with direct control. This is the objective of the whole thing. Exxon has control. Seven members of Trump's cabinet are Goldman Sachs. Seven members have relationships with Goldman Sachs. Goldman Sachs is back in business again. And four generals are part of his cabinet. So you got generals and finance capital that's running the show and the oil industry. That is the struggle to take control of the state, different sectors and sometimes contending sectors of the bourgeoisie. And the contention is still there. They're still fighting. All you got to do is watch CNN. Read the New York Times. See this unrelenting, ridiculous, extraordinary war that's being made against Trump. And you're looking at the continuous struggle. And when you look at these hearings, you're looking at sectors of the ruling class through their minions who are trying to establish what would be the policy determination of the Trump administration. So they ask Tillerson, what's your position on Russia? And Tillerson said, whatever yours is. And this is how they are changing it. And they're trying to create certain kinds of confrontation with Russia to deepen this problem. So that when Trump goes into office, no matter whatever the hell he thought he was going to do, they've already set the terms as much as they can about what he has to do. That's their objective. So that's all an election is. And I know you think elections are in the Bible, but that's not. That's how we get treated. You understand? It's not. It's another instrument that's in the possession of a ruling class. To protect itself, not to give you power. So what you and I have to do is say, what's it going to take for us to get our own power? And sometimes to get the power, we'll use perhaps the process that they have established for us, not because we think it's ours. We use it because they don't expect us to be in that arena. That arena was not established for us. The only time you can participate in that arena most of the time is when you say what they won't say, when you do what they won't do, when you come with their agenda. We say we have a national black political agenda for self-determination, and we will use every means necessary to attain this agenda. Every means. So, I ain't scared of Trump. I was scared of him before you got here. And I just think that's the whole question of our movement being organized and knowing where it is that we want to go. And the final other thing is this, that Trump, Clinton, Obama, none of them could be successful without the assistance of a certain sector of the African population that has sold out the black community, sold out black workers and poor people, and has carried out the mission of imperialism right in our own community sometimes. None of them could have been successful. And I'm going to say it. You might not like me saying it, but it's the truth, and you know it's the truth. And they work for white power. They look just like you. They go to the same dances you go to, but they work for white power. And I'm talking about Al Charlton, as one of them in Jesse Jackson. And there are a host of them who, when bad things happen to our people, they have access to media. They have access to questions. Jobs and the Democratic Party is on low, all kinds of questions bringing them to Washington, D.C. on today. Because the Democratic Party is fighting for his life, for his life, and Trump is fighting for his too. Because if the Democratic House of the Democratic Party burns down, that's Johnson's house that's burning down. And so that's what it is that we're looking at. And we have to acknowledge that is the truth. We have to acknowledge it. I was on a talk show, I think yesterday or the day before, here in Washington, D.C. And I said that Obama is a traitor. And that was really polite because FCC licensing won't allow me to say the kind of things I really thought about it. He's a traitor to black people. And we've gone on to apologize for him, but he couldn't, he had to say that. He had to do that. Folks didn't have to say that or do that. Folks doing what the hell he wants to do, and he's scared to death. You're scared to death. Don't tell me Obama couldn't have said anything. Well, if he'd have said it, white people wouldn't have elected, then that means that you don't need a black president. We're in a struggle for black power, you know? And it's been impolite to use terms like that over the last period with these neo-coin opportunists in our community. He's not my president. So what have you ever done? Hillary wouldn't have been your president either. So we have to move away from that process, because when you look at Trump and Clinton, what you were looking at is like slave owners on a slave ship, a sinking slave ship that's fighting for control. And here we are trying to get a better seat on the slave ship, depending on which one we think is going to get be in control. When what we should be doing is trying to drive more holes in the ship to sink this stuff so that we can protect the interests of ourselves and the people around the world.
Omali Yesha Taylor of the Black is Back Coalition. Almost 50 years ago, Dr. Martin Luther King's Poor People's Campaign was interrupted by his assassination, and the campaign never managed to get back on its feet. However, a range of organizations has banded together for a 21st century campaign against global economic injustice. Willie Baptist is a veteran of the welfare and housing rights movements and is currently an organizer with the Kairos Center at New York's Union Theological Center. He talks about the current Poor People's Campaign.
The idea of it was to continue the unfinished business of that campaign of 1968, the Poor People's Campaign. Of course, then you had the United States in the 60s was living at its highest. You had a growing middle class. And you had a section of the poor from every segment, including poor whites out of Appalachia. King brought them together to demonstrate problems of poverty in the midst of plenty. And 50 years later, the problem has gotten even worse. And in fact, due to the tremendous technological revolution that the country is undergoing, increasing segment of the population are being rendered unemployed or underemployed. These SLJs, we call them, city little jobs. And poverty has gotten worse, with huge sections of the middle strata, middle income, being rendered homeless, and a good section of the poor are being rendered superfluous. So we're living under conditions where poverty has gotten worse. It's reaching, again, every segment of the population. Of course, there's a disproportion with regard to people of color, blacks and Latinos. There's an even larger section of the poor that are poor whites in terms of absolute numbers. And in these one industry towns that have been deindustrialized, you have increasing pockets and concentration of poor whites in these small towns. So the Poor People's Campaign today is even much more necessary than was during Martin Luther King's time. And the possibility of ending poverty, which he recognized during that period, he saw that the wherewithal existed at that time to lift the load of poverty. He said in his sermons and his talks about that, that has become even more so the case. This country has the capabilities of producing the prefab house in 45 minutes. It has empty houses on stock, and yet the homeless population is growing by leaps and bounds. It's getting worse, especially since the 2008 crisis. And so the problems of poverty in its growing ranks domestically as well as globally has gotten worse. And so the Poor People's Campaign, the idea of the Poor People's Campaign is to finish the unfinished business of Dr. King and uniting the poor and dispossessed, all the people who hurt across color lines and all other lines of division, gender, you name it, every possible division or difference that's out there, that this common fact of people being impoverished in the richest country in the world and in a world economy that is capable of ending poverty and hunger, and yet the problem persists. And not only does it persist, it's getting worse. So this is the Poor People's Campaign. So far, a number of groups have answered the call to reignite the Reverend Dr. King's Poor People's Campaign. Lamar Mundy's Repairers of the Breach movement has come on board. Put People's First out of Pennsylvania, Vermont Workers Center, Teachucha Cultural Center, Tankofa, a number of other groupings across the bridge down in South, Michigan Welfare Rights. It's just a whole host of groupings that are growing, and it is indeed an idea whose time has come.
And those stingy little jobs, as you called them, that is, part-time jobs, contingent jobs, made up 94% of the new jobs under President Obama since the Great Recession. That tells us that some great restructuring has occurred in the economy.
Yeah, I think that's something that is very, very significant about these times. I mean, we're not talking about 68. We're talking about right now, the world is undergoing the unprecedented technological revolution in every area, from communication to retail to the economy, banking, robotics, and advanced technology is replacing human labor. It's not just saving labor, it's actually eliminating labor. And this process is underway on a global scale. The world's productive capacity just totally outweighs and overwhelms is purchasing capacity. That purchasing capacity is decreasing. And as a result, you have poverty in the midst of plenty. You have abandonment in the midst of abundance. This is a problem that we face. And the whole idea of the Poor People's Campaign is to put this question for debate and discussion, that this is not a problem of scarcity. We're not living in a problem where there's not enough, where you have to rob poor Peter to pay poor Paul, that there's enough for everybody to live a decent life. And the productive capacity is such that people can live even a lot better than they are living. As a consequence of the way the system is organized, that technology is being used to accumulate and concentrate enormous wealth in a few hands and to spread poverty all over the place. So we're living in this period, this time, and it's certainly a unique period in human history. But I think the Poor People's Campaign is a way to begin to address this, starting with the bottom. This country has always said you can do everything. You can organize blacks as blacks, and you can organize Hispanics as Hispanics, or Latinos as Latinos, and women as women, but do not unite the bottom. That's what King was killed over trying to do that. Fred Hampton was killed for trying to do that. Anybody that's tried to do this country has saw to it that effort is preempted. And we see that if we're going to move this country forward to have it realize the true meaning of its creed, everybody's created equal and are endowed with certain inalienable rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that we can pursue that provided that we start with the unity of the bottom. And this is what the Poor People's Campaign is all about. Everybody that hurt, that's what we're talking about, uniting them. And especially in this next period, because there's no way with the nature of the economy in these times that Trump is going to even be able to deliver to a lot of the poor working class whites out there as well. So this campaign is about digging in among that section that's going to be hurting from this growing crisis, and to unite them to push our country forward in terms of making for a transformation for a better life.
Looking at the bottom globally, a new Oxfam report shows that just 8 men control more wealth than the bottom half of the world's population, more wealth than 3.6 billion people. The United States has more billionaires by far than any other country, and the new president's cabinet is by far the richest ever assembled in this country.
Yeah, you know, this is where Dr. King was very prescient. He pointed out that true compassion is more than flinging a coin to a beggar. It's reconstructing the very edifice that produces the beggar. Well, the country also, this edifice also produces billionaires along with the beggars. And the contradiction is becoming more and more blatant, where you have fewer and fewer billionaires that control wealth and capital that's equivalent to a good section of the population, 3/4 of the world's population, is not living as well as just the few families that are concentrating as well. It's just the absurdity, the immorality of that kind of situation. You got people who have a summer home, a winter home, an auto home, and a home in Paris. You got millions and millions and millions of people ain't got no home. This is a discrepancy and a contradiction that we're trying to solve with this new Poor People's Campaign.
Then the solution to this problem requires the dispossession of these wealthy folks, not just from their riches, but from the power that grows from their riches.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, all this stuff amounts to a power that has to be confronted. And you only can meet power with power. I mean, this is what Malcolm X pointed out, that power only responds to power. And the power of the people is our numbers, but that number's got to be organized and led by knowledge and understanding. And this is what we're doing. Right now, we're out-moneyed, we're out-might, and we're out-media en masse. But we're taking the steps to build a critical mass of our numbers, organize that number so as to meet the power relationships as they exist that maintain this tremendous gulf between wealth and poverty. Yes. This question of power is got to be, in my view, kept in view in terms of the aim of building this powerful movement to end poverty led by those who are most impoverished.
Certainly, looking at the statistics, growing numbers of people are poor, and majorities of Americans are only a paycheck away from disaster. But do most people who are objectively poor understand themselves as being poor and belonging to a common economic group?
Well, you know, the propaganda and discussion of poverty over the past several decades, you know, has put a tremendous shame. The prominent notion is that it's not the society that has failed these individuals, but these individuals that have failed society. And we're trying to reverse that. The reality is that the nature of the system is based on procuring profit at the expense of human lives. And we want to put that out there for debate and discussion.
That was Willie Baptist of the Cairo Center and the Poor People's Campaign. A leading Afro-Colombian political activist and her partner have been assassinated as violence escalates against Black people seeking to defend their land in that South American nation. Emelson Manyoma was a leader of CONPAS, Communities Building Peace in the Territories. She was beheaded, it is assumed, by right-wing paramilitaries that have stepped up their terror in the wake of a peace deal between leftist guerrillas and the government. Charo Mina Rojas is also an Afro-Colombian political activist. She spoke about Ms. Manyoma's assassination.
This has shown how violence against community leaders, human rights defenders, and people that continue defending their right to territories are facing and are going to face in the years to come. One of the things that we have expressed many times is that part of the ceasefire and the agreements between FARC and the government bring some elements of peace, bring some tranquility to certain areas, but community leaders and organizations that continue their fight, struggle, protecting the rights, protecting the territories, we are going to continue facing strong violence and war in the territories. And the assassination of these leaders. It's a demonstration of that, as has been the assassination of over 200 leaders in the last year.
Tell us about the kind of work that Ms. Manyoma was doing.
First of all, she comes from a river community near Buenaventura. This is a region, an area that face all these large development projects that the government have been leading after the free trade agreement, with the expansion of the port and the mega tourist project. And she comes from a river that has been fighting heavily the presence of illegal groups trying to bring coca crops and illegal mining to those territories. But also she was very involved and work with a community of peace in Buenaventura, an urban area, where the communities that were constantly harassed, violent harassed by paramilitary groups, trying to get control of the territories, face them, and build up this peace community that has been constantly threatened by these groups. So we understand that her assassination responds to the kind of work that she was doing, defending the rights of black people.
Has there been a general increase in the activities of the paramilitaries since the conclusion of the peace deal?
In fact, a little bit before the conclusion of the deal, and yes, it has been increasing their activity. As I say, just last year, 2016, reached like over 200 people killed in different places in Colombia, some areas more than others. And after the signing, particularly in regions like the Cauca and Buenaventura, areas where with the demobilization process is going to be more focused, or areas where FARC had more presence, have been receiving the presence of armed groups. In our communities, we have received information of people armed that are not recognized as part of the community or part of the guerrilla groups coming into the territories, and the killings of some of leaders in these areas have increased severely.
Ms. Manyoma and her partner were beheaded. This would be a terror strategy, would it not?
Yes, definitely. They say the way that these groups always perform, you know, this is a strategy to start planting a seed of fear and terror to demobilize people and to encourage leaders in the communities to continue it, building peace and defending particularly their territorial rights. And, you know, for these groups, paramilitary groups, for them, we all are terrorists and guerrilla and left and identified as enemies. So definitely these are kind of signs and messages for all of us organizing and defending rights. Better be quiet and go back home.
But your organization and other Afro-Colombians don't plan on being quiet.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. You know, we know this is a long ride. For us, it's very, very important that the peace agreements with FARC have been reached and that there is a new green light for the conversations with the other group, the ELN. But we understand that the work on the territories is not mainly done by the guerrilla groups. We have all sorts of armed groups in the territories, and the problems in the territories and the war and the violence that happens in our territories is mainly rooted in the economic interest that are on those territories. And that economic interest also comes from government. So we are going to face severe violence. We are going to continue facing all these violent activities and war in the territories, economic violence, cultural violence. So we definitely are not going to stop fighting for the rights that we have defended for so long.
Well, when you say fighting for your rights, you're speaking of rights to land and right to develop as your communities see fit.
Right. Black people, we have the right to land, collective land, territories. We have the right to decide what kind of development, what kind of economic growth, what kind of economy we want in our territories. We have the right to participate politically. We have the right to organize. We have the right to our culture. All those rights are the rights that we defend, particularly territoriality and territories and collective property, because for us in our communities, without land, without territory, we cannot develop our being in that culture that identifies us and sustains us. So territorial is very important. Collective property and territories are very important. So we defend them because we know that as soon as we lose them, then we lose ourselves.
And those rights, in fact, have been recognized, at least on paper, in Colombia.
Yes, we have, in the Constitution, recognized that Colombia is a multicultural and multi-ethnic country. But then we have the law signed in 1993 that particularly have the recognition of collective title and the protection of the culture and the right to decide our own future, basically. And there are a series of laws nationally and internationally. We particularly apply International Labor Organization Convention 169, the ILO 169. Through that, we have the right to prior consultation and consent, which means that everything that is going to be in our territories, everything that is going to be done related to our rights, to our interests, to our culture, and that can impact that in a negative or positive way should be consulted with us and subject to our consent. Many of these multinationals and projects that come to our territories and try to take away all these things that we have been defending. So, yeah, there is a set of very comprehensive laws and important laws and regulations that we can use at least to fight to protect those rights.
That was Charo Mina Rojas, a Black political activist in Colombia, South America. Sean Ahern is an activist teacher in New York City. Ahern teaches incarcerated young people at the Rikers Island Jail. He's urging fellow union members to examine the reasons why Black and Latino teachers are disappearing from the city's classrooms and to do something about it.
In 2004, we came across some data that showed a very sharp decline in the number of Black and Latino teachers hired in 2002. And it coincided with the beginning of mayoral control under Mayor Bloomberg. And we also noticed that for decades prior to this point, there had been a slow but steady incremental increase in the number of Black and Latino teachers coming in to teach, and Asian teachers coming in to teach in New York City. Recall that, I grew up in New York City. I was a student in the 60s and graduated high school in 71. I was a ninth grader in 68. And the number of teachers, Black and Latino teachers, in New York City schools was minuscule. And you could probably count the principals and assistant principals on one hand. It was a major issue in the whole struggle over community control in the late 60s, 1968. It was one of the central focuses. And gradually, we came up to the point where there were Black teachers in New York City schools, Latino teachers, Asian teachers, not that many, still far below what the student body is, but they were there. And every year, it seemed to be more. This is just the data that we collected from the DOE, from the Independent Budget Office. So you can see, looking at this, you'll see, for example, in 2001, 2002, that's the last year before Bloomberg, you see 27.2% of the teachers hired in New York City were Black. Down to 2012, 2013, and it's 11.6%. So we saw, what's going on here? Nobody was talking about it. Nobody was paying any attention to it. So we started to go around and try to just stick these numbers in people's faces. Look at this. What's happening? This is moving in the wrong direction. And we went around to the UFT. We went around to teacher groups and community groups and CECs and anybody who would basically let us say something to try to draw attention to just these numbers. Like, what's up? finally, we got resolutions passed. Yours truly, Mark Torres, was involved in helping to bring a resolution in 2010 to the Delegate Assembly at the UFT. And a lot of people didn't really even want to talk about it. Like, and a lot of people became very defensive. What are you trying to say? A white teacher can't teach a black kid? Well, you know, people would get, sometimes it would get ugly, you know? But, and it was very discouraging that adults, educated adults, couldn't really think about this and have a conversation about this. It was hard. It was like hurt, you know? But we stuck with it, and now, guess what? Now, everybody's for teacher diversity. Our old friend John King from the New York State Education Department, now the Secretary of Education, he's got a big article in the Washington Post, you know, about the need for teacher diversity. Well, when he was here in New York, it was a very different story. So everybody's for it. The AFT came out with a 120-page pamphlet, Teacher Diversity. Mayor Bloomberg has just announced, you might see the ads in the subways, Men Teach, New York City. We're going to hire 1,000 black men to teach in New York schools by 2017.
De Blasio. Yeah.
De Blasio Center. You know, he hired this group. Wow. Sounds good. But so now that everybody's about teacher diversity, do you find it a little strange when everybody says they agree with this, but no one points to a single cause? That somebody realizes that, you know, if you can't find them, join them, and I'm gonna get in front of this issue, and I'm gonna make sure that it unfolds the way I want it to unfold.
Right.
Without touching anything or disturbing anything that actually is causing the problem in the first place. What is the machinery? What is these institutions? What are the policies and practices that cause a 10-year decline while the population, particularly of Latin students and Asian students, has increased? What's going on here? And if you really want to do something, wouldn't you want to say that's got to be changed, or this policy has to be changed, or doing this in the wrong way, but this has no basis, and this is a viable way to evaluate teachers or to hire teachers or attract them. There's no discussion. You hire a nonprofit, you give them money, they have an ad campaign, and I guess we're all supposed to just go to sleep, and because God knows there's a lot of other things that we can do with our time. So I talked about the education reform, because that's what we're talking about. None of these people talk about that somehow the disappearing of black and Latino educators is at all related to all those aspects of mayoral control and high-stakes testing and school closings and rubber rooms and ATRs and charter school push-ins. For some reason, this has nothing to do with anything that has happened in the last 15 years. We're just going to go out and put out the ads as if the problem was, well, the black and Latinos just weren't applying for the job. Maybe they didn't know the address. That's the problem. But when you look at what's actually been going on for the past 15 years, you see you begin to open it up and you see a very different picture. A picture that I believe requires people to point to the real causes of the disappearance in the first place, to change policy and practices in the New York City Department of Education. And by example, hopefully the country, because this is the biggest system in the country. And we're members of the biggest union local in the United States, left standing, you know? So I think that we could really do something very positive and very good by starting to look at the root causes of this thing and propose positive remedies. Not only, as we looked at it more, was not only the hiring that we saw as like wrong, but it was something else. In 2003, there were a large group of teachers marching around City Hall. They were marching, and I learned about the case of Galeno versus the Board of Education. What is that? Turns out that in 1998, the New York State Education Department mandated that every teacher in New York State had to pass a teacher certification exam, or they would be removed from their position. And we're talking about people who maybe had served 10 years.
And they lost their job.
They might have advanced degrees.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
If it had been up to a principal, they would have fought for this person. Nobody asked the principal's opinion. Nobody asked what their actual practice was in the classroom. Nobody consulted with any parents or community or anything. If you didn't pass this test, you're out. They announced it in 1998. By 2003, 10,000 people. Union members of the UFT, dues-paying members, people who had established careers as teachers, out the door. There wasn't a single, and I am a pro-union person, I'm a UFT delegate, there was not a single representative from the UFT leadership at that rally. 10,000 people. They filed the case, Galeno versus the Board of Education, and Bloomberg fought them tooth and nail for the next decade. Finally, new mayor, new judge, she made a ruling. She said, this test has never been validated. In other words, there has never been anything, no data, no study, anything, not a shred to show that this test has anything to do with teacher performance, student achievement, teacher retention, nothing. The SED, they just made up a test. Oh, we're the gatekeepers. We are the, we're the guardians. Everybody's got to pass this test that we're going to make. Well, they probably didn't even make it, right? They probably contracted it out to. So the judge says the test is not valid. And not only is it not valid, everybody is now part of a class who is affected by this. And the city is responsible to pay damages. So de Blasio, newly elected mayor de Blasio, to his credit said, I'm not going to do what Bloomberg did and just drag it out for another decade on appeals. I'm going to settle it. Okay, I'm not appealing. And the city is now stuck with the bill, probably around close to $400 million. I mean, they're still sorting out who is owed what. So now, in addition to the hiring practices, like, why are they hiring fewer and fewer Black and Latino teachers and hiring more and more young whites who don't stay, who cycle in and out of the system and, goes on their resume and off they go? TFAs. So now it's not just the hiring that they're doing, and they have an ideological mindset. Who's the ideal candidate? We want somebody from a prestigious private or public university, right? That's our model candidate. Is that necessarily going to be your best teacher? Is that somebody who's going to commit to serving in difficult schools? It doesn't matter. And they didn't need any evidence. It's a sort of elite arrogance that, the pedigree is there, And of course, right off the bat, if you're identifying that category as your ideal new teacher, well, chances are there's a lot more of them who are upper middle class or upper class white kids than there are kids who are coming from New York City, grew up in the projects, right, or went to a community college, right? So right there and then, by their framing of what is the ideal candidate, but now here they're kicking people out, they're pushing people out. So the thing is getting more complicated. Then as Bloomberg and Klein proceed to unfold their education reform, schools are being closed. Which schools? Guess. The underperforming, the failing schools, right? And where are these schools? These are in poor neighborhoods. These are predominantly Black and Latino kids, right? Project kids from the projects going there. Kids who maybe don't even have projects. Maybe they're sleeping in grandmother's house or whatever it is. Homeless kids. Kids in different with a lot of challenges, right? Now they're labeled as failures. Their school is a failure. And because we love you so much, we're going to shut it down. Guess who's the teachers predominantly in those schools? Disproportionately Black and Latino teachers. The school is closed down. Now the teachers don't have a permanent assignment. You could be a 30-year senior teacher with a doctorate.
And become an ATR.
And now you're an ATR. And maybe if you got really stressed out and you got really pissed off and you yelled at somebody or maybe even cursed somebody out, now you're in the rubber room. A detention center for bad teachers. We're not talking about child rapists. We're not talking about drug addicts. We're talking about people who maybe, you know, didn't get along with the principal or said the wrong thing at the wrong time. Now you are in the rubber room. So who is in the rubber rooms? Again, it's predominantly or disproportionately Black and Latino educators.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host, Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.